Welcome to our episode today with Catherine Cook Catone, who has written a beautiful book called Trauma Informed and Trauma Responsive Yoga Teaching, a Universal Practice. And her co-author is Joanne Spence, who is not able to be here today. And I received this book a few months ago, and I was actually in awe. I was in shock at the comprehensive nature of this book and just how much is packed into it. I feel like it needs to be on every single person's shelf if you're a yoga teacher or a yoga therapist. And, you know, some of you know that in the past, I've been a little leery to use the word trauma-informed yoga because I think it puts the emphasis on trauma and trauma-informed instead of putting the emphasis on yoga. And this comes from a keynote talk that was given by Sham Ranganatham a few years ago at the International Association of Yoga Therapists National Conference. He basically said he didn't like the idea of trauma-informed yoga, that basically yoga is inherently trauma-informed and that we're looking at the whole person. We're not looking at them as a trauma victim. And I think Catherine and I get into that kind of nuanced discussion and still why the book is about being trauma-informed and trauma-responsive. So I hope that you will appreciate that nuanced conversation. And I think coming out of it, I feel very comfortable with this title and what is happening in this book. It's actually very, very amazing. So let's just get right into the interview. I think Catherine can say it best, and I'm really grateful that she took her life force to write this book, and I'm really grateful that she's willing to do this interview and help us to understand all of these concepts with more clarity. All right, let's go say hello. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. We hope that you're enjoying this podcast each and every week. In addition to this podcast, Marlisa Sullivan and myself, Amy Wheeler, we are hosting a group inside the Polyvagal Institute. It's a free group where you can learn about yoga, yoga therapy, and polyvagal theory. We'd love to have you come on over there too to enjoy some of that free content. And I'll put the link in the show notes so that you can get over there easily. All right, let's go over and meet our guest for today. Welcome, Catherine Cook Catone. I'm so happy to have you here representing yourself and Joanne Spence, because both of you are the authors of Trauma Informed and Trauma Responsive Yoga Teaching, a Universal Practice. So welcome.
Well, thank you for having me and allowing me to represent Joanne. Well, she's in her travels, and I'm saying we because Joanne's right here in my heart. I'm super honored to be here.
Wonderful. Catherine, I think you wanted to start with kind of an opening acknowledgement from your new book with Joanne, and I'm really touched by this. So go ahead and lead us through that.
We have it right here in the book. So if this is something that really speaks to you and you want to open your workshops with it, close workshops, any classes, have this posted in your yoga studio, feel free to take, borrow, modify as you'd like. So I'll begin. Yoga is an ancient practice developed in South Asia. As a practitioner, yoga teacher, yoga therapist, and researcher, I am grateful for yoga philosophy and practices. I am also grateful to those who shared these practices and philosophies with my teachers and to my teachers who shared them with me. I acknowledge that my understanding of yoga, its tradition, philosophies, and practices is limited. I am committed with humility to my practice and understanding of yoga.
Beautiful, because I think many of us are in the situation that the more we learn, the more we realize I really didn't know any better. You realize like the more you know, the more you realize you just don't know. So it's a nice acknowledgement. I appreciate that.
Yeah, and I think there's so much in the past few decades, of course, I can see from my perspective at my age, And I'm sure my elders would say, of course, right? But I'm really getting to the age where I wrote a book that includes yoga practices in 2013, so 10 years ago. And I read now what I thought I knew then, right? And it was a different version of me. And we evolve, we learn, and we are doing the best we can, especially when we so love a practice that we're really presenting and teaching from the best of our abilities and always open to grow and learn. And so I think coming from that place is really important.
Absolutely. Well, that kind of brings us to the title of your book. I'm just going to put it on screen for those who are watching this on YouTube or any other video version of it. Trauma-Informed and Trauma-Responsive Yoga Teaching, A Universal Practice. So tell us about that, because there's been a lot of, I don't want to say controversy about the word trauma-informed, but there has, you know, some people feel very strongly that we should be focusing on individuals, human beings who have trauma. We should be focusing on the wholeness of the person, not trauma, that we shouldn't approach it like, oh, I'm doing this from a trauma lens. It should be, here's a whole person and part of that person has trauma. So why is it important to have the words trauma informed and trauma responsive?
I get that point of view. And I think that's true. I think always holding the whole person as we're teaching, sharing, or doing yoga therapy, I think that's extraordinarily important, not to lose the person when we're orienting or trying to think through any particular experience, any disorder, any focus. So I agree with that perspective. And I would add that the trauma-informed field is, I guess, now a few decades old, and it started in healthcare. And what was happening is that patients were coming in and providers didn't have a sense of what PTSD looked like, what trauma expression looked like, and they didn't understand how some of the practices in the healthcare system were in fact traumatizing, or what we would call potentially traumatizing, right? So the whole trauma-informed initiative started was to, okay, first of all, let's not traumatize our patients while they're coming in for care. And importantly, that we're going to understand what is the difference between somebody being shut down in trauma symptoms or hypervigilant and defensiveness, or somebody appearing resistant or belligerent, right? When they're completely in a trauma reaction. So how do we understand patients through a trauma-informed lens? And I like to think of like, it as a lens that it helps us kind of see more clearly, as opposed to a filter that, oh, now I'm only going to see everyone only as trauma, right? So it's just this corrective lens. It's going to expand what we can see, as opposed to a filter that limits what we can see. So a trauma-informed lens, and that means that trauma-informed, that I know about what trauma looks like, I know the symptoms, and then I'm beginning to think about that as I deliver whatever it is I'm delivering, right? It could be that I'm a nurse, it could be I'm a psychologist, a yoga therapist, a yoga teacher, a lawyer, et cetera.
I think it's important to understand those symptoms, because otherwise it just seems like you seeing like, oh, these are coping mechanisms because that person has experienced trauma.
Right. And then the trauma responsive piece, and Joanne and I and Seeing Dragon Press, our editors, were really working on the title. And of course, anyone in marketing wants it to be, you know, short, quick, to the point, really delivering what the book's about. And our title is not that. But trauma responsive is the other piece. So trauma-informed is the knowledge part, and then the responsive is that my practices, what I'm delivering, really are there to know what to do, right? How to deliver what specific practices. Now, when we're talking about as I'm teaching a yoga class or doing yoga therapy, would help support somebody who potentially may have trauma. And what's important to remember, even if we look at the statistics for gender-based violence, we're talking about 1 in 4 or 1 in 3 women have experienced gender-based violence. So in any yoga class, you're going to have people who've had trauma, even if they're walking into your community studio, And then if you have specific populations, like if you're doing prison-based work or domestic violence shelters, like we do here in our not-for-profit, you might have 100% of the participants. So you're not saying, oh, these are traumatized people, but that I want to practice in a way that really creates access to a body who's been through trauma to these practices.
You know, it's so interesting that we started off the talk with the acknowledgement, because in all my years of study in India, this wasn't really talked about. And so I do think this is something that the Western world, as long as we keep that idea of we're looking at a whole human being that is not just a trauma victim, you know, we're not categorizing people and just trying to treat the trauma, and I put that in air quotes. As long as we do that, I actually think this is such an important addition to the studies that we've learned from our Indian, South Indian teachers. And it was just in 25 years, I've never really heard them talk about it like you are.
Well, and importantly, the whole tradition of yoga is really inherently trauma-informed. I mean, Sutra 1-1, this is the teaching of yoga, and Sutra 1-2, yoga is the stopping of the turning of the mind. And so this second sutra is essentially talking about self-regulation, and then we go on to learn. So I've come to learn this. It's not yoga necessarily that needs to be trauma-informed. It's the teachers, the yoga therapists. It's us as deliverers of the practice that need to be trauma-informed and trauma-responsive. And the practice itself is already inherently, intrinsically this way.
That's interesting. I'm writing a book right now with Marlisa Sullivan, and I'm going through all the sutras word by word through the lens of autonomic nervous system regulation. And it's exactly what you're saying. It's already all there. Maybe we just have a different language for that.
Yeah. And that makes sense to me why then it's not there, because it's already there. So you don't have to add on. Now you take what we're doing to try to teach people. How do I teach a class in a yoga studio? How do I teach a class in a hospital? How do I teach a class at a domestic violence shelter? How do I teach classes in a carceral setting, in a cancer institute? So now we're thinking a little differently than when we're thinking about applications and our delivery methods. So that's the responsive part then, is about the methodologies. And as a yoga teacher, trainer, and a psychologist, I would add that it's important for me, for yoga teachers, to know how to do a de-escalation protocol, right? How to acknowledge and see and support somebody that might be in a trauma response. So we did the trauma-informed, we did trauma-responsive, and then why it's yoga teaching and not yoga. And the last part, a universal practice. And this was Joanne, it was really important to her that that was part of our title, and that there's not a trauma-informed class over here and this class. That it's just a universal practice, because this is important that every yoga teacher has these tools. And there wouldn't be any class in particular that this one's trauma-informed and that one's not. You know, that this is what all yoga teachers should know how to do. And so we don't even have to put a title on it. It's funny, because a couple years ago, Yogis in Service is a not-for-profit I work with, and we were doing yoga at this community center, and they put a big sign, trauma-informed yoga. And we were like teaching yoga, right? And so I'm like, can we make a new sign? So I don't know who's going to even come to this class, because it was just at this fun community event, right? So all yoga is really trauma-informed. And so we don't need that extra part on the sign.
I have to say, I agree with you, but it is inherently trauma-informed and hopefully trauma-responsive. However, growing up in the 1990s, it was not that. It was serious workout. It was zero boundaries between teacher and student. It was more like what you might see at a Zumba class or a step aerobics class. Like, it was very much in that vein. And people were crying in class. People were having little breakdowns in class, but it was actually considered in the 90s like a good thing, like, oh, they're releasing, you know. When I did my very first training with Donna Farhi, who I consider to be a wonderful, amazing yoga teacher, we didn't talk about these things. So I agree with you. And I also think there are still a lot of teachers out there that really need more education and need the book that you have written.
I don't know if there's anything more wonderful than a good yoga cry. I'm sure. I guess the love for my children and my dogs and just the practice of yoga, but it's a very cleansing experience. And so part of it too is like just making space, like human expression. Laura Douglas is so good talking about that. There's just a space for all feelings, all expression, right? And that as the yoga teacher, that we are skilled in holding that space and supporting our students. Right. Yeah. And that there isn't anything going on that would be as much as we can, right? That's not going to be providing additional trauma or that way. One thing that's really important, and I know we're perhaps going to talk about it later, but it just makes sense here. So the whole idea of choice, right? This ongoing informed consent is just so critical. And for people who have experienced trauma, and even people who have experienced the conditioning of growing up as a woman in our culture, maybe not even experiencing this opportunity to make choices about their bodies. So this idea of a teacher in a class, a yoga class, offering choice just throughout the class is such a really therapeutic and healing experience to truly be able to choose. And if you can create a class where your students feel like they can choose to drop a knee, to go into child's pose, to lay down and drink water the whole time. Like I had a student who was pregnant and she would come and do some of the cat-cows in class and then sit in the corner and eat her bananas and drink water and like not do any of the, she's a good friend of mine, but she's like, I want to be here. I want to hear the whole thing. I want to be in the practice. But her choice was, I want to be here in a way that is me getting nourishment and lots of water and just being with the class. And that to me is a beautiful class when someone feels free enough to do that.
You know, that's one of the reasons I love teaching online, because people can choose to be off camera and they can choose to not have any kind of peer pressure about, do I have to look like everybody else? Do I have to do this thing I don't feel like doing today? Like, I know there's some problems with online teaching too, but that in particular, I just love that, that there's no pressure to conform.
Yeah. So this whole idea of I get to experiment with choice, and that's yoga, right? My first training was through the Himalayan Institute. And really the way we were trained was that this is all just an experiment with your body, and you're exploring your sensations, and you're exploring how your sensations are related to your choices, and how your choices then are related back to your sensations, and how that connects to the expression of your soul. So it's all this experiment of the body. So following a sequence is part of that in some cases. And then how I relate to that sequence becomes a whole nother part of it. So this is the yoga.
Which is so different than, I've got this choreography and we've got this music and everybody needs to keep up. And if somebody decides to do their own thing, I'm going to be offended as the teacher because they must not like my teaching or my sequence. And you know, it's just such a total mindset shift to say, this is about the students. It's for them to experience whatever they need to experience. I love that. It's less of a performance for the yoga teacher and more of being of service to the student.
Right. I've had lots of different experiences teaching yoga, including doing it through research studies, you know, for people with eating disorders, for individuals with trauma in different countries. So I've seen all different expressions of self, from doing Shavasana sitting up with eyes open because it doesn't feel safe not to have your back against a wall and being able to see the door with your own eyes, right? To other people that have, you know, a blanket over their face and they're snoring and it's all Shavasana, right? Being the teacher is really working to create a foundation for this self-exploration to happen.
So would you say the kind of the essence of all of this trauma-informed and trauma-responsive yoga teaching comes down to allowing the student to feel safe and to feel safe enough to express their needs, feel safe enough to be in relationship with the teacher? I mean, do you think it boils down to safety? Is there something more than that?
Yeah, so that is an interesting concept as well. You've probably heard people say, you know, this is a safe space. And I'm sure I've said that in the past. And that's our goal. We want to create this space that is safe for everyone, a practice that is safe for everyone. But as it turns out, that safety is a completely and utterly subjective experience and only can happen inside of a person's body as they experience whatever is happening in relation to their past, in relation to all of the experiences they bring in and all their fears that they have coming in. So the idea is to really work to create an environment where someone can make informed choices, right? And decide, given the context of the state of their body. Part of the book, we talk about the polyvagal theory and how it relates to a yoga student walking into your class, as well as your state as you're teaching, and then the interactions of the states and how these two nervous systems, and then of course in a group, all these nervous systems are relating in terms of, am I safe or not, right? And Stephen Porges calls this neuroception, but this continuous assessment of the environment and others for, do I feel safe enough to connect, or do I not feel safe enough? And in fact, do I need to protect, right? And Deborah Dana explains Stephen Porges' work so well. She does with this connection protection dynamic, right? And so we want to relate as yoga teachers in a way that our system is in a state that really is open for others to connect with us. And we are in this connection state. In this way, we are more trustworthy. We are predictable. We're saying what's going to happen. We're offering choices, and our nervous systems are doing our work. So we're regulated. And then the student comes in, right? And we are able to notice and observe and, you know, what state they're in. And then their work is to yoga 1.2 sutra, you know, they're going to work on their states and manage that. And it's a fascinating thing how much is going on in one dyad, let alone a whole class. And this is why it is a book. It's not a pamphlet, right? It's like, there's a lot, the science of the nervous systems, and then what are all the things we can do? So we talk in that way about really working on ourselves, our studio, our cueing, our interactions, our communication. This even has nonviolent communication in it, right? All of this stuff that can lead to a nervous system that could potentially in this learn and grow and experiment and figure out their own safety. It's long-winded.
Hello, are you interested in polyvagal theory? Well, if so, I have two really cool things you might be interested in. One is an app called the Mighty Network, where Marlisa Sullivan and myself are hosting a yoga therapy and polyvagal theory group, and it's free. You can just join the group, come in and share thoughts and ideas on polyvagal theory, yoga, and yoga therapy. We try to post every week, stimulating a community around yoga, the nervous system, and polyvagal theory. So we'd love to have you join us. In addition, we are giving a 7-week class on polyvagal theory and yoga starting in the fall. You can find that on www.polyvagalinstitute.org. O-R-G. So we'd love to invite you to that 7-week course that's starting in September of 2024.
Beautifully said. And the thing that really stands out to me in what you just said is the teacher's nervous system needs to be well regulated as a starting point. Like, nothing can happen until the teacher is well regulated, because that's forming the foundation for everything else. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. So we can't give what we do not have, right? And as a yoga teacher, and as a psychologist, and as a yoga therapist, it's really important that I do my work with my nervous system every day so that I can come into an interaction regulated and open, ventral vagal complex, right? In a way that someone feels like they could come in to the interaction and potentially expand what Dan Siegel and Pat Ogden call their window of tolerance, right? Where my nervous system can play and experiment and grow without feeling like I'm in danger. This nervous system here has done a lot of that work and does that work so that I'm a safe partner with whom to do that. And I can subjectively say safe. In the book, we have a self-regulation scale, right? Where we take the polyvagal theory, window of tolerance, all this, and create a scaling system, which is something we do in psychology. But from 1 to 10, very simple. And I can be regulated, nice, calm, relaxed, rest, restore, 1 to 2, or in a working zone, which is still ventral vagal, like 3 to 6, and not in 7 to 10, fight, flight, freeze. I can be here and say, I feel safe. And still for the person walking into a yoga studio for the first time, not sure, they're rolling in maybe at a 7, even if I'm a 3. So I still can't say I'm safe to them. That makes sense.
Well, I think it's interesting because I think we all are triggered by different types of people. They remind us of our mother, or I have a bad memory of that kind of person, again, in air quotes. And even if that person did their work, the teacher did their work and came in regularly with a 3, it doesn't mean I'm safe for that student. And I think that's kind of fascinating too, to recognize that due to past habitual memories and leftover residuals and patterns in our life, we are not going to be safe for everyone. And that's okay.
Yeah, it's humbling. We go into this work really wanting to help others as sometimes an identity, right? And so we want to make sure, and I know I can speak for myself, I want to make sure that even though that is so important to me, that it isn't so tied to my identity that someone having their own experience is actually becomes threatening, right? Like they become in charge of somehow responsible for my identity. And then all of a sudden, how is that helpful, right? Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely. Our sense of competence as a teacher is something that's reflected back from our students. Are they smiling? Are they socially engaged? Are they connecting? Or are they having a really hard time? I think any human being that is not a narcissist would just inherently, especially a yoga teacher or yoga therapist, think, oh, have I done something that contributed to that person's suffering that I need to clean up or that I didn't realize? How can I be supportive? And it may or may not have anything to do with us.
Oh, right. I think in psychology training, we are responsible for what's happening in the room. But yeah, like we play with transference and countertransference as like a way of being as a psychologist. Maybe we don't learn enough about that in yoga teacher training. I was just thinking, I wanted to say, and I didn't make this distinction earlier, that being trauma-informed and trauma-responsive as a yoga teacher doesn't mean that you treat yoga. David Emerson is a good example because he partners with psychologists. And I took his training. So my understanding of his work is working with people who have been through trauma and they are coming to the yoga as an adjunct to their treatment to really work through their trauma specifically as a pathway to growth. Just like I might create a protocol, a yoga protocol for working through disordered eating and body image and that, right? So this is a different thing, really a yoga, more kind of yoga therapy approach. So trauma-informed and trauma-responsive yoga teaching universal practice is really about just this really general approach. And we're not trying to treat anyone's trauma. We're teaching yoga, and we don't want whatever our behaviors are to get in the way of access to yoga, especially to bodies who may have gone through trauma. So I just want to make that distinction.
I am so glad you said that, because we are not treating the trauma, but we may need to make referrals too. Meaning if something comes up out of the scope of practice of yoga teachers or yoga therapist, we obviously need to be able to say, I think this would be better suited for you to see a psychologist regarding what's come up for you.
Yeah. So when I do trainings in this, well, it's really fun. We'll take all the attendees, everybody stands up. And then one side of the room is, this is the yoga teacher's job. And the other side of the room is, this is a referral. And then we'll set up scenarios and you go, you walk to the side of the room that you think it is. And sometimes, depending on the scenario, people are on both sides. And then we have people speak to, why did you think that's a yoga teacher's job? And they'll say, well, because of this and this and this. And so, and then the other side, some people will walk over, change sides. And then we'll say over here, well, why do you think this is a referral? And they'll say, and then people change sides. And it's a really wonderful activity because scope of practice is muddy water. It's so hard. And it's very difficult to know when I should refer somebody. So I'm going to speak to that for a second. So you're teaching a yoga class. We'll talk about just a typical yoga teacher in a yoga studio. If somebody is staying after class and has done so once, okay, and there's like, this happened for me and I'm going through a divorce, and now the next class they're staying after again, I would say definitely by the third time, now three, we have a pattern. Consider that they might not be going to a therapist because they're starting to think you're the therapist, right? And then we're getting in the way of them getting help by somebody who's trained in marriage counseling and to truly get them help. So same if they are like, boy, my shoulder and I don't know if I tore, like physical therapist, right? So this is when we're saying like, oh, okay, I know a few yoga poses to loosen it up, but I would really get that checked. And I have these cards of my favorite PT who's also a yoga teacher. So really knowing when we're not practicing in our scope of practice as a yoga teacher, we put our students at risk by not getting them appropriate and quick referral to where they can get their, whatever they're working on or struggling with, get that support from a professional really trained in that area. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And, you know, it is muddy water because, you know, if we look at texts like the Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, it talks about how when we do yoga, these asanas come up, these kind of old feelings and sensations and memories start to emerge to be digested. I think maybe in the ancient times that it was more integrated. Maybe there wasn't a psychologist that your insurance covered that you could get referred to. I think that makes it very muddy. And, you know, we have to keep asking ourselves, is this something that I feel competent and that I'm qualified to do versus, okay, is this something that I should really be referring out? And I love that activity of people thinking through it and switching sides of the room. It just shows how complicated it could be. And I think shows why we need yoga mentors ourselves as teachers to help us with these types of things that are muddy.
And friends who are psychologists and friends who are nutritionists and friends who are physical therapists, that you can run it by that, you know, like, hey, someone's coming in, what do you think? And they're like, oh, definitely, right? Then that's also why the book specific to trauma talks about, here are the symptoms of PTSD, so that if you have somebody who's starting to show signs of PTSD in your class, that's a referral, right? Because you're teaching a yoga class and it's not a treatment for PTSD. Does that mean they don't come to class? No, come to class. And that is definitely something that there are protocols that are known to work that psychologists are trained in, and you could benefit from that support. So come to class, and here's three psychologists that I know are yoga informed. Some of them are yoga teachers that you might really like, mental health counselors, social workers. Nutrition's a big thing in yoga as well, right? And I do a lot of work with eating disorders. If the nutrition questions are really beyond, you know, pretty much our basic understanding, and the person's having symptoms, they have irritable bowel, or they are having trouble maintaining weight, then that's a nutritionist or dietitian and their primary care physician, right? To really talk to them. That's now getting outside of our scope.
And, you know, going back to something you talked about at the beginning, the de-escalation strategies, what do you look for? And what are some of these strategies when you see someone having a really hard time in class?
So I can tell you an example. I'm just going to change some of the details just so the person's protected. So this is part true, part fiction, just to protect a person, although it's okay with this person for me to tell this story. So it was after a yoga teacher training, we were just going over trauma, and someone in the class had shared, we talked about only using 5-pound weights to share, weights that we can keep our form, and not 250-pound weight shares. Sometimes the topic comes up, and even though the person knows the guidelines, they share something that's pretty traumatizing because it's just pushing out. They are dysregulated, it comes out. So someone had shared something pretty intense. And so everybody left training, and I was picking up stuff and putting it in my bag, and a student walked over, and she was clearly dissociated and was trying to tell me that she was very upset over what the other person had said, and that she had been triggered, and she felt like she wasn't even here. Her words were disjointed. There wasn't even a clear that she was present. She wasn't really oriented for time, space. So I got her to walk over to a bench. We were in a gym, there are bleachers. And so I said, let's sit down for a second. So I sat with her and I said, let's press our feet into the floor. So what I was getting her to go from this cognitive, like she's in this other trauma response that had a story and cognitions and that we're not in the here and now. So I was bringing her to the here and now. So feet, sitting bones, and then slowing her breath. Her heart rate was fast. She was beginning to sweat. We started there. And sometimes that's enough. I make sure that I am either at the same height as them or lower. In this case for her too, I actually slid myself off the bench and got down even lower. Her assault was a physical assault. And so I wanted to make sure I was not like over her. And so I sat down, I was a little bit lower next to her. And I just said, is it okay if I put my hand on your back? And it was, she said, yes. And I had a feeling, an intuition that that was something I should ask. So you want to listen to yourself a lot, not go like, this is the thing to do. Because I also might've had a feeling like she don't touch her at all. Right? So I'm asking, and I just rested my hand on her back. And then I said, let's just breathe. That usually is enough for many people. It wasn't. She was not regulating. So then I said, okay, let's look around. Tell me how many basketball hoops there are. So she looks up and I was like, okay, that was great. Like that, now she's getting back here. And then we did, I think we did bleacher sets. I said, how many different lines? You can do the basic one is like five things you see, four things or that you can hear or touch, like three things hear or touch, two things you can smell. So I often say, tell me one thing that you know to be true, no matter what. I say, I love my dog Finnegan. Just hard stop, right? What's yours? And so got her eventually, I think it took 10 minutes of that, like sensate focus. You can even add a bit of a protocol and like, okay, where are we? What school are we in, right? So that's now, and what you're thinking about was then. So you do this here, now, that, then protocol. But essentially, that's it. And now for her, that was a referral, right? Because that response was pretty significant. And so she goes, you know, I was in therapy a while ago, and I thought that I had it, you know, under control is how she framed it. She goes, but I think I'm going to get back. So and I said, good, good, right? And she was back at the next training and completely regulated. So that's an example.
When she first walked up to you and she was triggered, did she know how dissociated she was? Did she know that she wasn't in the present moment with you, or was she oblivious to that? Because I think there are many people that don't realize they've gone into those states, and that can be confusing too.
Yeah, she knew because she has her own training experience that outside of yoga that she knew. Plus, we had just gone over it too. So she did know. So you want to look at if you can't get eye contact, not that someone's shy, you get this sense. And as you do your work in the yoga field, you'll get a sense where that energetic connection's not there. Like they're not there. The only way I can say it is like gone, dissociated, like not present. Right. And so you want to get him back here. I horseback ride a lot. And sometimes our horses are rescue. It's the same thing. I don't want to ride or work with a horse that's not here. And you can feel it like, okay, buddy. And we might have to do some like groundwork and walk around till they're here. So it's this felt sense. And so if you're hearing this podcast and you don't know what I'm talking about, live the question of what is that like and start really paying attention to how connected and present you feel with others in different situations. And it's not ideal to be constantly like Amy and I are very connected right now, even from miles apart because we're having this conversation, but we wouldn't act like that every minute that we are together. It's really normal for a connection to wax and wane. But if somebody's coming to you with something pretty intense, yet they don't seem here, or they became very dysregulated in class and they are not self-regulating or even hearing that you're trying to help, that's that disconnection. So you can just experiment, like how connected do I feel right now? Right? How disconnected as you're just interacting with others. So you get a good sense of it.
I'm listening to you and what's coming to me, and maybe I shouldn't say this, but after training yoga teachers and yoga therapists for so many decades, there are a lot of yoga teachers and yoga therapists in training. They show up in this way. And I think many of them don't know that they're having a trauma response. They don't realize they're disembodied or triggered. And it comes out as attacking the teacher or the training or, you know, it's yeah. fascinating. And even after discussions like this, it still doesn't occur. And this happened to me too, frankly. I have these discussions and I'm thinking, oh, those other people that are dissociated, those other people that are, you know, triggered, like not even realizing I am completely showing up that way. And it's just fascinating to me because I think we as yoga teachers and yoga therapists are wounded healers and we're trying to work through it, but we haven't realized that we are that person. What do you think of that?
It's because we all are that person. So in this book, I wrote this section here where you go through the different polyvagal states and you journal about each one. So let's say you're in rest and restore, which is very connection state, very calm, and on the self-regulation scale, like a one or a two. You'd spend some time thinking about that state, contemplating it, and maybe meditating about it, and get a sense of what are the markers I feel in my body? What are the emotions that tend to occur while I'm in that state? And then what are the thoughts? And it would be, I am, others are, the world is. And generally, when we're in that state, you know, we feel comfort, we feel satisfaction, we feel senses of safety, trustworthiness, peacefulness, gentle, like happiness. And then our thoughts are like, I'm a good person, you know? And then you think about others, you know, there's a lot of people out there, but people are just inherently good for the most part, right? And then you're thinking about the world and you're like, you know, there's a lot going on, but there's hope for the world. And you can start to see how our state is really connected to the emotions and also our thoughts. And then you go to the next state, which would be like an alert engagement. So a 3 or 4 on the scale. And there, and I won't go through all of them. That would be take us the whole podcast. But I would have, you know, a different physiology. Well, now I have more muscle, not tension, but activity. I have like that sthira and the sthira sukha is present. My breath rate is faster. Yeah, I'm able to move and articulate. And then my thoughts, my feelings can be complicated. I can be like interesting and happy. And then my thoughts are a little more complex, but thoughtful and curious and not like driven, so to speak. But we go all the way to fight, which could be a 7 on the activation scale, like fight or flight. And I'm up there 7, 8. And I tend to be flight more than fight, although I can go into fight. And then it starts to be like, and it's funny because I can hear my activation as I'm talking about them. So now I might be starting to get a little sweaty. My voice is different. There's more pressure behind it. I have more muscle tension. Even now, my thoughts aren't as fluid as much as they're driven. And then I start to have ideas about people. Well, I don't know if people are safe. I don't even know if I like myself. Like in the world, oh my gosh, are you following the politics, right? And so we start to go there. And so they start to kind of get narrow and closed and restrictive, and it's definitely in protection state. The mistake is thinking any nervous system at all, including your own, doesn't have the full range because we're designed this way. We're human beings, right? We want to think like, oh, not good people stay under a 6 because that doesn't make any sense. There's good people who go to a 10 about something really important, right? And they don't want to be at a 10 maybe because they won't be as effective as they want to be. But it happens when you're like really caring or driven or terrified, right? So it's not character. It's just what's the state of my nervous system? And then given what I notice about it, what do I need to do to regulate it? Or am I good? Like, right? So that's a piece of what we're noticing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I love that differentiation that we all move up and down the scale. Yeah. But it sounds to me like it could also be if I notice that I am consistently at a 7, 8, 9, or 10, and I'm always feeling that way, that that is showing me that I'm not weaving in and out and my nervous system is no longer flexible.
So at that point too, I would think I want to get more support. So yoga is really good for that. Yoga was for the first time I remember without a substance in my adult life that I was able to get down to a 3 or a 2. And I was like, I have not been this way in my body without a substance, right? Just wonderful. So for someone who's locked into these fear-driven states, which I would say I was for many years, gosh, the practice is just amazing to really teach you more about your body and its capacity to rest and restore. And therapy is really good to help move that along. Yoga therapy and traditional therapy.
Absolutely. Well, Catherine, I think we have uncovered more questions than answers today. Like every single thing we talked about could have its own 1 hour podcast. And when I read your book several months ago, I got a copy. I was amazed at the depth, both, you know, the research and the psychology and the yoga, but also the application. Like, this is a comprehensive guide. You had held it up on camera to see how thick it is. I really do feel when I read it, I thought every single yoga teacher and every single yoga therapist needs to not just read this book, but to really go deep into this.
Yeah, I should say, just for everybody out there who's listening, I literally have only scraped the very surface. We designed every chapter with questions for teacher trainings or yourself, if you want to do this as a self-led training at the end of every chapter. And it really goes through we go through sensations. There's two chapters on sensations. There's two chapters on emotions. Joanne worked with an artist to fully create practices that help you stimulate, integrate, balance, calm. We go into cueing in depth. We could have a whole podcast on, should I assist? How do you assist? What's trauma-informed, you know, assisting practice, right? That is all in here. How to create your space. So there's just so much that you're just going to have to buy the book.
Are the two of you, one or both, together or individually, going to start having like regular workshops? Are you getting invited to teacher trainings?
Yeah, I have a Nashville thing that I do every year with Small World Yoga. I've done that for a couple of years now. We're going to be at Kripalu in August. I think at the time this podcast comes out, that will have happened. But definitely reach out to us if you're interested in that kind of thing. And also use the book in your teacher trainings. Our goal was truly to make it a universal practice. So we are happy to help, but also you can do it. And we're happy to support that too. Our goal was to really create access to yoga for all bodies by having access to the tools for trauma-informed and trauma-responsive yoga teaching.
Well, thank you for giving us your life force to create such a legacy book. I know things will change and we'll be in a different place 10 and 15 and 20 years from now, but the relevance of this right here, right now for all of us it's magnificent. It's one of those books that will always, always, always be on my shelf. You know how you go clean out your books and think, oh, I don't need that one. No, this one will 100% always be on my shelf. And in fact, it actually might be back there.
Well, I want to add one more part. I keep thinking of all the things. I want to shout out to Dr. Shirley Tullis and Dr. Gail Parker. So they wrote forewords, and Shirley really came from the researcher perspective, and she is the leading research in yoga in the world. And she works at the Patanjali Institute in India and just highly respected researcher. So her foreword comes from that perspective. And then Gail Parker, I think she should take the foreword of this book and write a memoir. Her foreword brought tears to my eyes. And so if you buy this book only for, or borrow the book or find a place where you can read her foreword, you should do it. It's just so beautifully written, and it comes from her heart and how yoga practice really speaks to her and her life. So I wanted to also point out those forewords because they mean a lot to me.
They both are very beautiful. I would completely agree. Okay. Well, I think unfortunately we're out of time. There's so many more things we could talk about. Maybe we'll have you and Joanne come back at another time to follow up on some of those. But I just want to thank you for being here and especially for writing the book. It's really a profound and powerful offering to the field.
Well, thank you so much, Amy. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine, for being with us today. It was such a pleasure and honor to speak with you. And I just want to finish the podcast with just one more little thought about those of us, whether we are yoga students, yoga teachers, yoga therapists, that don't realize we are in that space of disembodiment because we're so triggered. I really learned this through the work of Stephen Porges and polyvagal theory. When I saw that term called dorsal vagal, I was like, what does that mean? And, you know, in my body, it feels like my legs are hollow, like I'm walking around on stilts and my legs are hollow. And so once I heard that term, I just checked in with my body. Like, am I feeling like I have hollow legs? Do they feel numb? Sometimes they feel like they're cement blocks. And that was the start of my journey to understand that I too can become disembodied and triggered to a point where I'm no longer inhabiting my nervous system. And so I think, you know, many of us just need to check in with ourselves. We hear these terms, we throw them around, we teach them, and yet we ourselves don't understand that that's happening inside of us. I had one person that went through our entire training and learned about all of this trauma stuff, if you will, graduated, and then later came back and said, I didn't know it during the training, but this has been happening to me my whole life. And it feels so normal and natural to me that I didn't put together that that was happening in my body at the same time I was learning the theoretical concepts. And I didn't understand that that was happening to me because it felt so normal and natural in my body. So, you know, there was finally an event that happened that gave this person the aha moment, like, oh my gosh, I didn't know that was me. So I just wanted to throw that out there because I think it's really interesting how we can learn about it intellectually. You know, cognitively, we understand a lot of these concepts, but we ourselves are not even aware that it's happening inside of us. And I think that's really fascinating thing to reflect upon. And I love that Catherine and Joanne have kind of given clues in this book about how to question ourselves. And I would even say that the Optimal State mobile app does the same. For those of you that can see me on the screen on YouTube, you know, our mobile app, it's so interesting. It checks in with you every few hours to ask you, what state are you in? Both your mental, emotional state, your pain state, your somatic state, like it tracks all of this for you and then gives you data so that you can understand what state am I in most of the time. So that was a big part of why we created the app, was to help us understand the actual state that we're in and what that is like somatically inside of our own bodies, and then get the data back to see, oh my gosh, I'm in Vata imbalance 72% of the time. Whoa, what is that about? I think it's so interesting how we don't really see the patterns. We're too close to it. So anyway, I just want to thank Joanne and Catherine for writing this book. And I think we all have so much to learn from it. Have a great week and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. After several years of beta testing, we are finally ready to build a community around a mobile app, the Optimal State app on Android Store and in the iPhone Store. On this app, we're going to start hosting classes, regular meditation circles, and really start to build a community of yoga teachers, yoga therapists, Ayurvedic practitioners, and healthcare practitioners that want to come together on a regular basis and have a community that is empathetic and compassionate and kind and full of goodness, that wants to grow spiritually together. So come on over to the app. You can download it now, try it for a month for free, and we'll be having regular community online offerings through the app, and we would love to see you over there. All right, we'll see you soon.
A special thank you to our team here at Optimal State. We are truly a global family. George Mantuan, one of our executive producers. Adam Satchel, Senior Media Producer and Sound Engineer from the Philippines. Krishna Panchal, a producer from Canada. Modupe Abdullahi, who does the show notes and is an editor for us from Nigeria. And Peter Morley, who wrote and produced the music for this show, who lives in Australia. Find more about Peter's work at www.zenmusic.biz. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.